A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been watching the Israeli public dissect the Prime Minister's October 7th diary, almost minute by minute. What hour he woke up, what hour he called the IDF Chief of Staff. And his read is that it feels like a witch hunt, people mining the timeline for anything that can be used as ammunition. He said before that the 30-minute standard people are applying is almost inhuman, that virtually no leader would meet it when the ground is shifting under them. But he's pushing past the blame question to something more interesting. If we stop asking whether the Prime Minister was slow, and start asking whether the system was designed to survive a slow Prime Minister, what do we find? He's drawing the backup and failover parallel we've used for technical systems, and applying it to governance. Any production system of serious magnitude assumes a component will fail. But a system for emergency authorization of military force depends on one person being awake, healthy, and mentally sharp at the exact moment the unforeseen happens. The chief of the army could have food poisoning, the head of the country could be having a mental health episode, and Daniel's point is that nobody wants to discuss this because any admission of fallibility gets weaponized by the opposition. So the question he wants to explore is how other countries handle this principle in practice. And how nations have done retrospectives after tragedy that actually internalized the lesson instead of just finding someone to blame.
The thing that strikes me about the Israeli discourse right now is that it's not a retrospective at all. A retrospective asks what the system assumed and whether those assumptions held. What Daniel's describing is a forensic biography. People are reconstructing a person's morning, not an architecture's failure modes, and those are different activities with different outputs.
Right. One produces a scapegoat, the other produces a change system.
The 30-minute thing is a good place to start, because it exposes what people are actually demanding. In the first minutes of an unprecedented mass casualty attack, you don't have a clear picture of what's happening. You have fragments. Reports coming in from different sectors, some of them contradictory. The difference between knowing something happened and understanding that it's a coordinated invasion isn't a small gap. It's the entire fog of war compressed into the worst possible window. The idea that a leader should process scattered reports and authorize a full military response in under 30 minutes assumes the information arrives pre-sorted, pre-verified, and labeled with its strategic significance. That's not how it arrives.
It arrives as noise. And the leader's job in that first window is to figure out which noise is signal before committing forces to the wrong response.
And here's the thing that bugs me about the discourse. Nobody asking the 30-minute question has ever been woken at 6:30 in the morning with a phone call saying something terrible is happening, but we don't know what. I have. In medicine, not in military command, but the cognitive load is the same shape. You get a call at 3 in the morning from a nurse saying a patient is crashing. You don't jump out of bed and start issuing orders. You ask questions. What are the vitals? When did it start? What's already been done? The first few minutes are information gathering, not action. And if you skip that and just start doing things, you kill people.
That's the part the witch hunt misses. The delay they're attacking may have been the information gathering that prevented a worse mistake. We don't know that, but neither do they. And the certainty with which they're assigning negligence is itself a failure of epistemic humility.
Daniel's reframe is the useful one. Not was the Prime Minister slow, but was the system designed to survive a slow Prime Minister? And the answer is no, it wasn't. The system assumed a leader who would be awake, reachable, cognitively sharp, and emotionally regulated at the exact moment the unprecedented happened. That's not a design. That's a hope with a phone number attached.
This is where the technical parallel gets uncomfortable. In any serious production system, you assume every component will fail. The disk will fail. The network will partition. The database will go down. So you build replicas, failover paths, redundancy. You don't assume the primary node will be available at the critical moment, because the entire discipline of reliability engineering is built on the opposite assumption. Components fail. Design for it.
Governance systems assume infallibility. Not explicitly, but in their architecture. The chain of command is a single path. The authorization flow depends on one person making a decision. There's no replica set for the head of state. And the reason isn't technical, it's political. Acknowledging that the leader might be incapacitated means acknowledging that the leader is human. And in a political culture that treats any admission of weakness as a weapon, that acknowledgement never happens in public.
So the system stays fragile. And fragility is fine until it isn't. The problem is that when it isn't, the cost is measured in lives, not in downtime.
Let me bring in the aviation parallel, because Daniel mentioned it, and it's the cleanest example of the principle working. Aviation solved this decades ago. The industry's core insight was that pilots are human, and humans make errors. Not occasionally, not in emergencies, but systematically and predictably. So the system was redesigned around that fact. Checklists, cross-checks, crew resource management. The captain isn't assumed to be infallible. The captain is assumed to be fallible, and the system is built so that fallibility doesn't crash the plane.
And crew resource management is the specific thing worth naming here. The system explicitly empowers the co-pilot to challenge the captain, not as a courtesy, but as a duty. If the co-pilot sees the captain making an error, the co-pilot is expected to speak up, and the captain is trained to listen. That's a design decision. It says the hierarchy isn't the same as the truth, and the truth is more important than the hierarchy.
The fascinating thing is that this was a cultural revolution in aviation. Before crew resource management, the captain was the authority. The co-pilot was the assistant. Challenging the captain was insubordination. And that culture killed people. There's a long list of crashes where the co-pilot saw the problem but didn't speak up because the hierarchy didn't permit it. The Tenerife disaster, the crash in the Everglades where the crew was fixated on a landing gear light while the plane descended into the swamp. The system had to be redesigned to make it safe for the co-pilot to say the captain is wrong.
And the redesign worked. Aviation accidents dropped dramatically. Not because pilots stopped making errors, but because the system stopped depending on pilots not making errors. The errors still happen. They just get caught.
Now ask yourself what the governance equivalent of crew resource management would look like. A deputy who's expected to challenge the leader. A standing rule that says if the leader isn't processing information well, the deputy acts. A protocol for what happens when the primary decision maker is awake and reachable but not functioning. We don't have that. We have a chain of command that assumes the person at the top is the person who should be at the top, and if they're not, well, that's a political problem, not a design problem.
The failure pattern Daniel listed are worth taking seriously. A medical crisis, a mental health episode. These aren't exotic scenarios. Over decades of leadership, the probability that a leader will be impaired at some critical moment isn't trivial. And the consequences of the system depending on that single node are catastrophic. But we don't design for it, because designing for it means admitting it's possible.
There's a deeper problem here. The reason leaders never admit fallibility is that the admission gets weaponized. Daniel said this, and he's right. If a leader says I have a backup system because I might be incapacitated, the opposition doesn't hear a mature system design. They hear an admission of weakness. They hear the leader saying, I can't be trusted to do my job. And the next election cycle turns it into an attack ad. So the conversation never happens in public, and the system never gets designed for reality.
That's the trap. The political culture punishes the honesty that would enable the design. So the system stays fragile, and the fragility is invisible until a failure exposes it. And then the retrospective collapses into scapegoating, because scapegoating is easier than admitting the architecture was wrong.
The distinction between accountability and witch hunt matters here. Accountability asks what went wrong and who was responsible, but it does so in the service of preventing recurrence. A witch hunt asks, who can we blame, and it stops there. The Israeli public discourse right now has collapsed into the latter. It's not producing system improvements. It's producing a target.
And the target is a person, not a design. Which means, even if the person is removed, the design remains. The single point of failure is still there. The next leader will be just as human, just as fallible, and just as dependent on being awake and sharp at the critical moment. Nothing will have changed.
This is where the international comparison gets interesting. Other nations have grappled with the single point of failure problem in emergency military authorization, and some of them have actually built redundancy into the system. The most dramatic example is the U.S. Nuclear Launch Authority debate. The constitutional question of whether one person should have sole authority to order a nuclear strike has been debated for decades. It's a live design question, not a settled one.
The argument for sole authority is speed. Nuclear response windows are measured in minutes. You can't have a committee debate when missiles are incoming. So the system concentrates authority in one person for speed. The argument against is exactly Daniel's point. That one person might be impaired, might be having a bad day, might be mentally unwell. And the consequences of a single impaired decision are existential.
The 25th Amendment is the rare example of designing for leader unavailability. Section 4 provides a mechanism for transferring power when a president is incapacitated. The vice president and a majority of the cabinet can declare the president unable to discharge the duties of the office. It's a constitutional failsafe. It's also almost never discussed in design terms. People talk about it as a political weapon, not as a redundancy mechanism. But that's what it is. It's a replica set for the head of state.
And the fact that it exists at all is instructive. The framers of the 25th Amendment recognized that the system needed a failover path. They didn't assume the president would always be available. They built a mechanism for when the president isn't. That system's thinking, even if it's rarely framed that way.
The U.S. Nuclear Launch Authority debate is different. There's no failover for the nuclear decision. The president has sole authority, and the system is designed around the assumption that the president will be available and functional when the decision is needed. There's no 25th Amendment equivalent for the nuclear trigger. And that's a deliberate choice because distributing nuclear authority creates its own risks. But it's a choice that depends on a single human node being functional at the critical moment.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question. What would a diversified emergency authorization system actually look like? Pre-delegated authority, deputy chains, standing rules of engagement that don't require a single human decision at the moment of crisis. The technical systems we build have all of these. The governance systems we live under have almost none.
Pre-delegated authority is the interesting one. You decide in advance, in calm conditions, what the response will be to certain classes of events. Then, when the event happens, the response is already authorized. The commander on the ground doesn't need to call the prime minister. The prime minister doesn't need to be awake. The decision was made weeks or months ago when everyone was rested and the information was clear.
That's exactly how technical failover works. You don't decide in the middle of an outage what to do. You decide in advance, write the runbook, and the system executes it automatically when the failure is detected. The human doesn't need to be awake at 3 a.m. The human already made the decision.
The tension is accountability. If authority is distributed, who's accountable when something goes wrong? The pre-delegation means the leader made the decision in advance, but the commander on the ground executed it. If the execution was wrong, is the leader responsible for the bad decision or the commander for the bad execution? Democratic accountability depends on clear lines of responsibility. Redundancy blurs those lines.
That's the trade-off Daniel's question exposes. Resilience versus responsibility. A system with no single point of failure is a system where no single person is clearly responsible. And democratic accountability requires someone to be clearly responsible. So there's a genuine tension between the engineering ideal and the political reality.
The retrospectives are where this plays out. Israel has a formal mechanism for this. The State Commission of Inquiry into October 7th is the proper venue for a systemic review. It's distinct from the political blame seeking in public discourse. A state commission has the authority to subpoena documents, compel testimony, and produce findings that carry legal weight. It's not a political exercise. It's a judicial one.
And Israel has done this before. The Agranat Commission, after the Yom Kippur War in 1973, is the historical precedent. That commission investigated the intelligence failures that allowed the surprise attack. It cleared the political leadership, Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan, of direct responsibility, but it led to significant structural changes in military intelligence. The system was redesigned because the retrospective focused on the system, not the individuals.
Though it's worth noting the political consequences were still severe. Golda Meir resigned under public pressure even though the commission cleared her. The public didn't accept the systemic framing. They wanted someone to blame. And that's the pattern Daniel's observing now. The formal retrospective can produce good system analysis, but the public discourse runs on blame, not architecture.
The U.S. 9/11 Commission is the other example. It produced structural recommendations that led to the creation of the Director of National Intelligence. That's an architectural change. The retrospective identified a systemic failure, the failure of intelligence agencies to share information, and the fix was a new organizational structure, not a scapegoat, a redesign.
The pattern is clear. Mature retrospectives ask what the system assumed and whether those assumptions held. They produce architectural changes. Immature retrospectives ask who was slow and produce a target. The difference isn't the severity of the failure, it's the maturity of the culture conducting the review.
And the deeper cultural problem is that mature systems design requires admitting fallibility, but political culture punishes that admission. So the system remains fragile until a failure forces change, and even then the retrospective often collapses into scapegoating, because scapegoating is easier than redesigning the architecture.
The aviation industry had an advantage. When a plane crashes, the investigation is conducted by engineers and pilots who share a professional culture of learning from failure. The goal is to find the systemic cause and fix it. There's no political opposition trying to weaponize the finding. The National Transportation Safety Board doesn't have to worry about the next election, so the culture can be mature.
Governance doesn't have that luxury. The retrospective is conducted in a political environment where every finding is ammunition. So, the incentive is to produce findings that can be used as ammunition, not findings that can improve the system. The architecture stays fragile because fixing it requires a consensus that the political environment prevents.
I keep coming back to something Daniel said. The chief of the army could have food poisoning. The head of the country could be having a mental health episode. These aren't hypotheticals. They're statistical certainties over a long enough timeline. And yet the system has no answer for them. The chain of command assumes the person at the top is functional. If they're not, the system doesn't fail over. It just fails.
Or it depends on someone breaking the rules, which is its own kind of failure. A system that works because someone was willing to violate the protocol is a system that hasn't been designed. It's a system that's been rescued.
The protocols I wrote assumed the commander was either alive or dead. That was the entire decision tree. If he's dead, the deputy takes over. If he's alive, he's in command. There was nothing in between. Nobody wanted to write the section that said, if the commander is alive and reachable, but not processing information well, here's who acts without waiting for permission.
That's the gap. The binary assumes the only failure pattern is unavailability, but the more likely failure pattern is degraded function.
I spent 2 years in the early 2000s as a civilian contractor for a NATO Rapid Response Coordination Unit. Continuity of command protocols. That was the whole job. What happens if the designated commander is unreachable during an activation window? We had binders full of procedures for every scenario we could imagine. Commander dead, deputy takes over. Commander captured, next in line. Commander unreachable, the clock runs out and authority shifts to the regional command. It was absurdly detailed. And it completely missed the scenario that actually happened in the drills.
What happened in the drills?
We ran a simulation. Simulated attack, activation window open, commander in the room, and he froze. Just sat there. The reports were coming in, the clock was running, and he sat there. The deputy had to physically take the phone from his hand, took the phone and gave the order himself. The after-action report called it hesitation, under uncertainty, and recommended more training. As if the problem was that he hadn't practiced sitting there enough.
So the system had a protocol for a dead commander and no protocol for a human one.
The system assumed the problem was skill, not humanity. If the commander hesitates, train him better. If he freezes, drill him more. Nobody wanted to write the protocol that said, if the commander is having a human moment, here's who acts without waiting for permission. Because that protocol admits the commander is human. And in a command structure, admitting the commander is human is the one thing nobody will put in writing.
The deputy who took the phone, was he authorized to give that order?
No. He wasn't in the chain of command for that decision. He did it anyway, and the system worked because he did it. The after-action report praised his initiative, which is the polite way of saying the system worked because someone was willing to break the rules. That's not a design. That's a rescue.
Which raises the uncomfortable question. Is the real backup system just the courage of subordinates? And can you design for that?
You can't design for courage. You can design for authority. Pre-delegated authority. Standing rules that say if the commander is non-responsive, the deputy has the authority to act without waiting for permission. We could have written that protocol. It'd have taken an afternoon, but nobody wanted to sign it, because signing it means saying the commander might not be able to command, and that's the one sentence that never makes it into the binders.
So the binders had a gap. Not a technical gap, a political gap. The protocol that was needed was the one that was unpalatable to write.
The binders were complete in every way except the one that mattered. Which is about what you'd expect from a system designed by people who were more afraid of looking disloyal than of being wrong.
The deputy's action worked because he was willing to be insubordinate at the exact moment it was necessary. But that's not something you can rely on. Most people won't break the rules. Most people will wait for permission. And in the scenario where waiting is catastrophic, the system fails.
Unless the system gives them permission in advance. That's the pre-delegation idea. You don't need courage if the authority is already there. The deputy doesn't have to break the rules if the rules already say the deputy acts when the commander is non-responsive. The courage becomes unnecessary because the design already accounted for the failure.
That's the protocol we never wrote. And I'll tell you why. Because writing it means defining non-responsive. Is it 30 seconds without a response? 30 minutes? Does it include the commander who's responding, but responding wrong? The commander who's awake and talking, but not making sense? The legal department didn't want to touch that. The command structure didn't want to touch that. So we left it out and hoped the deputy would be brave.
Hope isn't a design principle.
No. It's what you have when you don't have a design.
The thing I keep thinking about is how close this maps to the medical world. In a code blue, we don't depend on a single physician being sharp. We have a team. The nurse calls the code, the respiratory therapist starts bagging, someone starts compressions, and the physician arrives and directs. But if the physician freezes, the team keeps working. The protocols are already running. The physician's hesitation doesn't stop the compressions. The system was designed so that the critical functions continue even if the leader hesitates.
Because in medicine, everyone has seen a physician freeze. It's not a hypothetical, it's a known failure pattern, so the system accounts for it. The protocols run automatically. The team has standing authorization to act. The physician's role is to direct. But the system doesn't depend on the physician being functional at every moment.
And the reason medicine can design for this is that medicine doesn't have a political opposition waiting to weaponize the admission that physicians are human. The admission is just a fact of the profession. Everyone knows it. So the system gets designed for reality.
Covenants doesn't have that luxury. The admission that leaders are human gets weaponized, so the system gets designed for a fantasy. And the fantasy is that the leader will be awake, sharp, and decisive at the exact moment the unprecedented happens.
The open question Daniel's prompt leaves us with is whether a democracy can design for leader fallibility without undermining democratic accountability. If authority is distributed, who does the public hold responsible when something goes wrong? The leader who pre-delegated? The deputy who acted? The system that authorized the action? The clarity of responsibility is what makes democratic accountability work. Redundancy blurs that clarity.
And yet the alternative is a system that depends on a single human being functional at the critical moment, which isn't a system. It's a gamble. And the gamble is made with other people's lives.
I don't have a clean answer to that. I think the honest answer is that there's a genuine tension here. The engineering ideal says no single point of failure. The democratic ideal says clear lines of accountability. And those two ideals pull in opposite directions. The best systems find a compromise, but the compromise is always uncomfortable.
The cutting room floor detail I keep thinking about is that the 25th Amendment Section 4 has never actually been invoked. The mechanism exists, the failover path is there, but it's never been used. Which means we don't actually know if it works. We know it's written down. We don't know if the system would actually transfer power smoothly in a real crisis. The replica set exists on paper, but it's never been tested in production.
And that's the thing about failover systems. You don't know if they work until you need them. And if you've never tested them, the first real test is the crisis itself, which is exactly when you can't afford to discover the bug.
The October 7th inquiry will tell us something important. Not about the Prime Minister's mourning, but about whether the system is capable of learning. If the inquiry produces architectural change, If it asks what the system assumed and whether those assumptions held, then the retrospective will have done its job. If it produces a scapegoat, the system will remain fragile, waiting for the next unprecedented morning.
The uncomfortable truth underneath all of this is that every system has a single point of failure somewhere. The most dangerous ones are the ones we refuse to acknowledge, because acknowledging them feels like disloyalty. The commander who might freeze. The leader who might be having a bad day. The human at the top of the chain who is, despite everything, still human.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, for keeping the show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us a prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.